content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the September 17th, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. From the Profiles section, Ghost in the Machine. Can Mark Zuckerberg fix Facebook before it breaks democracy? By Evan Osnos. At 10 o'clock on a weekday morning in August, Mark Zuckerberg, the chairman and CEO of Facebook, opened the front door of his house in Palo Alto, California, wearing the tight smile of obligation. He does not enjoy interviews, especially after 2 years of ceaseless controversy. Having got his start as a programmer with a nocturnal bent, he is also not a morning person. Walking toward the kitchen, which has a long farmhouse table and cabinets painted forest green, he said, "I haven't eaten breakfast yet. Have you?" Since 2011, Zuckerberg has lived in a century-old white-clappered craftsman in the Crescent Park neighborhood, an enclave of giant oaks and historic homes not far from Stanford University. The house, which cost $7 million, affords him a sense of sanctuary. It's set back from the road, shielded by hedges, a wall, and mature trees. Guests enter through an arched wooden gate and follow a long gravel path to a front lawn with a saltwater pool in the center. The year after Zuckerberg bought the house, he and his longtime girlfriend, Priscilla Chan, held their wedding in the backyard, which encompasses gardens, a pond, and a shaded pavilion. Since then, they have had two children and acquired a 700-acre estate in Hawaii, a ski retreat in Montana, and a four-story townhouse on Liberty Hill in San Francisco. But the family's full-time residence is here, a 10-minute drive from Facebook's headquarters. Occasionally, Zuckerberg records a Facebook video from the backyard or the dinner table, as is expected of a man who built his fortune exhorting employees to keep pushing the world in the direction of making it more open and transparent. But his appetite for personal openness is limited. Although Zuckerberg is the most famous entrepreneur of his generation, he remains elusive to everyone but a small circle of family and friends, and his efforts to protect his privacy inevitably attract attention. The local press has chronicled his feud with a developer who announced plans to build a mansion that would look into Zuckerberg's master bedroom. After a legal fight, the developer gave up, and Zuckerberg spent $44 million to buy the houses surrounding his. Over the years, he has come to believe that he will always be the subject of criticism. "We're not. Pick your non-controversial business. Selling dog food," although I think that people who do that probably say that there is controversy in that too, but this is an inherently cultural thing, he told me of his business. "It's at the intersection of technology and psychology, and it's very personal." He carried a plate of banana bread and a carafe of water into the living room and settled onto a navy blue velvet sofa. Since co-founding Facebook in 2004, his uniform has evolved from hoodies and flip-flops to his current outfit, a gray sweater, indigo jeans, and black Nikes. At 34, Zuckerberg, who has very fair skin, a tall forehead, and large eyes, is leaner than when he first became a public figure more than a decade ago. On the porch, next to the front door, he keeps a Peloton stationary bike, a favorite accessory in the tech world, which live streams a personal trainer to your home. Zuckerberg uses the machine, but he does not love cycling. A few years ago, on his first attempt to use a road bike with racing pedals, he forgot to unclip, tipped over, and broke his arm. "Except for cycling on his porch," he said, "I haven't clipped in since." He and his wife prefer board games to television, and within reach of the couch, I noticed a game called Ricochet Robots. "It gets extremely competitive," Zuckerberg said. We play these games with friends, and one of them is a genius at this. Playing with him is just infuriating. Dave Morin, a former Facebook employee who is the founder and CEO of Sunrise Bio, a startup seeking cures for depression, used to play Risk with Zuckerberg at the office. He's not playing you in a game of Risk. He's playing you in a game of games, Morin told me. The first game, he might amass all his armies on one property. And the next game, he might spread them all over the place. He's trying to figure out the psychological way to beat you in all the games. Across the tech industry, the depth of Zuckerberg's desire to win is often remarked upon. Dick Costolo, the former CEO of Twitter, told me, he's a ruthless execution machine, and if he has decided to come after you, you're going to take a beating. Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, said, there are a number of people in the Valley who have a perception of Mark that he's really aggressive and competitive. I think some people are a little hesitant about him from that perspective. Hoffman has been an investor in Facebook since its early days, but for a long time he sensed that Zuckerberg kept his distance because they were both building social networks. For many years, it was like, your LinkedIn thing is going to be crushed, so even though we're friendly, I don't want to get too close to you personally because I'm going to crush you. Now, of course, that's behind us and we're good friends. When I asked Zuckerberg about this reputation, he framed the dynamic differently. The survival of any social media business rests on network effects, in which the value of the network grows only by finding new users. As a result, he said, there's a natural zero-sumness. If we're going to achieve what we want to, it's not just about building the best features. It's about building the best community. He added, I care about succeeding. And yes, sometimes you have to beat someone to something in order to get the next thing done. But that's not primarily the way that I think I roll. For many years, Zuckerberg ended Facebook meetings with the half-joking exhortation, domination. Although he eventually stopped doing this. In European legal system, dominance refers to corporate monopoly. His discomfort with losing is undimmed. A few years ago, he played Scrabble on a corporate jet with a friend's daughter who was in high school at the time. She won. Before they played a second game, he wrote a simple computer program that would look up his letters in the dictionary so that he could choose from all possible words. Zuckerberg's program had a narrow lead when the flight landed. The girl told me, during the game in which I was playing the program, everyone around us was taking sides, Team Human and Team Machine. If Facebook were a country, it would have the largest population on Earth. More than 2.2 billion people, about a third of humanity, log in at least once a month. That user base has no precedent in the history of American enterprise. 14 years after it was founded, in Zuckerberg's dorm room, Facebook has as many adherents as Christianity. A couple of years ago, the company was still reveling in its power. By collecting vast quantities of information about its users, it allows advertisers to target people with precision, a business model that earns Facebook more ad revenue in a year than all American newspapers combined. Zuckerberg was spending much of his time conferring with heads of state and unveiling plans of fantastical ambition, such as building giant drones that would beam free internet, including Facebook, into developing countries. He enjoyed extraordinary control over his company. In addition to his positions as chairman and CEO, he controlled about 60% of shareholder votes, thanks to a special class of stock with 10 times the power of ordinary shares. His personal fortune had grown to more than $60 billion. Facebook was one of four companies, along with Google, Amazon, and Apple, that dominated the internet. The combined value of their stock is larger than the GDP of France. For years, Facebook had heard concerns about its use of private data and its ability to shape people's behavior. The company's troubles came to a head during the presidential election of 2016, when propagandists used the site to spread misinformation that helped turn society against itself. Some of the culprits were profiteers who gamed Facebook's automated systems with toxic political clickbait known as fake news. In a prime example, at least 100 websites were traced to Veles, Macedonia, a small city where entrepreneurs, some still in high school, discovered that posting fabrications to pro-Donald Trump Facebook groups unleashed geysers of traffic. Fake news sources also paid Facebook to micro-target ad users who had proved susceptible in the past. The other culprits, according to U.S. intelligence, were Russian agents who wanted to sow political chaos and help Trump win. In February, Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating Russia's role in the election, charged 13 Russians with an interference operation that made use of Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Internet Research Agency, a firm in St. Petersburg working for the Kremlin, drew hundreds of thousands of users to Facebook groups optimized to stoke outrage, including Secured Borders, Blacktivist, and Defend the Second. They used Facebook to organize offline rallies and brought Facebook ads intended to hurt Hillary Clinton's standing among Democratic voters. One read, "Hillary Clinton doesn't deserve the black vote." With fewer than 100 operatives, the IRA achieved an astonishing impact. Facebook estimates that the content reached as many as 150 million users. At the same time, former Facebook executives, echoing a growing body of research, began to voice misgivings about the company's role in exacerbating isolation, outrage, and addictive behaviors. One of the largest studies, published last year in the Medical Journal of Epidemiology, followed the Facebook use of more than 5,000 people over 3 years and found that higher use correlated with self-reported declines in physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction. At an event in November 2017, Sean Parker, Facebook's first president, called himself a, quote, conscientious objector to social media, saying, "God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains." A few days later, a former vice president of user growth told an audience at Stanford, "The short-term, dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. No civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation, mistruth." The prominent Silicon Valley figure who worked at Facebook from 2007 to 2011 said, "I feel tremendous guilt. I think we all knew in the back of our minds." Of his children, he added, "They're not allowed to use this stuff." Facebook replied to the remarks in a statement, noting that he had left 6 years earlier and adding, "Facebook was a very different company back then." In March, Facebook was confronted with an even larger scandal. The Times and the British newspaper The Observer reported that a researcher had gained access to the personal information of Facebook users and sold it to Cambridge Analytica, a consultancy hired by Trump and other Republicans, which advertised using psychographic techniques to manipulate voter behavior. In all, the personal data of 87 million people had been harvested. Moreover, Facebook had known of the problem since December of 2015, but had said nothing to users or regulators. The company acknowledged the breach only after the press discovered it. The Cambridge Analytica revelations touch off the most serious crisis in Facebook's history and, with it, a public reckoning with the power of big tech. Facebook is now under investigation by the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Department of Justice, and the Federal Trade Commission, as well by authorities abroad from London to Brussels to Sydney. Facebook's peers and rivals have expressed conspicuously little sympathy. Elon Musk deleted his Facebook pages and those of his companies Tesla and SpaceX. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, told an interviewer, "We could make a ton of money if we monetized our customers. But we've elected not to do that." At Facebook's annual shareholder meeting in May, executives struggled to keep order. An investor who interrupted the agenda to argue against Zuckerberg's renomination as chairman was removed. Outside, an airplane flew a banner that read, "You broke democracy." It was paid for by Freedom from Facebook, a coalition of progressive groups that have asked the FTC to break up the company into smaller units. On July 25th, Facebook's stock price dropped 19%, cutting its market value by $119 billion, the largest one-day drop in Wall Street history. Nick Bilton, a technology writer at Vanity Fair, tweeted that Zuckerberg was losing $2.7 million per second, double what the average American makes in an entire lifetime. Facebook's user base had flatlined in the U.S. and Canada and dropped slightly in Europe. And executives warned that revenue growth would decline further, in part because the scandals had led users to opt out of allowing Facebook to collect some data. Facebook depends on trust, and the events of the past 2 years had made people wonder whether the company deserved it. Zuckerberg's friends describe his travails as a byproduct of his success. He's often compared to another Harvard dropout, Bill Gates, who has been his mentor in business and philanthropy. Gates told me, "Somebody who's smart and rich and ends up not acknowledging problems as quickly as they should will be attacked as arrogant. That comes with the territory." He added, "I wouldn't say that Mark's an arrogant individual, but to critics, Facebook is guilty of a willful blindness driven by greed, naivete, and contempt for oversight." In a series of conversations over the summer, I talked to Zuckerberg about Facebook's problems and about his underlying views on technology and society. We spoke at his home, at his office, and by phone. I also interviewed 4 dozen people inside and outside the company about its culture, his performance, and his decision-making. I found Zuckerberg straining, not always coherently, to grasp problems for which he was plainly unprepared. These are not technical puzzles to be cracked in the middle of the night, but some of the subtlest aspects of human affairs, including the meaning of truth, the limits of free speech, and the origins of violence. Zuckerberg is now at the center of a full-fledged debate about the moral character of Silicon Valley and the conscience of its leaders. Leslie Berlin, an historian of technology at Stanford, told me, "For a long time, Silicon Valley enjoyed an unencumbered embrace in America. And now everyone says, is this a trick?" And the question Mark Zuckerberg is dealing with is, should my company be the arbiter of truth and decency for 2 billion people? Nobody in the history of technology has dealt with that. Long before it seemed inevitable or even plausible, Mark Elliott Zuckerberg had an outsized sense of his own potential. It was a teleological frame of feeling almost chosen, a longtime friend told me. I think Mark has always seen himself as a man of history, someone who is destined to be great, and I mean that in the broadest sense of the term. Zuckerberg has observed that more than a few giants of history grew up in bourgeois comfort near big cities and then channeled those advantages into transformative power. In Zuckerberg's case, the setting was Dobbs Ferry, New York, a Westchester County suburb 25 miles north of New York City. His mother, Karen Kempner, grew up in Queens. On a blind date, she met a mailman's son, Edward Zuckerberg of Flatbush, who was studying to be a dentist. They married and had 4 children. Mark, the only boy, was the second oldest. His mother, who had become a psychiatrist, eventually gave up her career to take care of the kids and manage the dental office, which was connected to the family home. Of his father, Zuckerberg told me, "He was a dentist, but he was also a huge techie. So he had always had not just a system for drilling teeth, but like the laser system for drilling teeth that was controlled by the computer." Ed Zuckerberg marketed himself as the painless Dr. Z, and later drummed up dentistry business with a direct mail solicitation that declared, "I am literally the father of Facebook." Since 2013, Zuckerberg's parents have lived in California, where Ed practices part-time and lectures on using social media to attract patients. In the 1980s and 90s, Ed bought early personal computers, the Atari 800, the IBM XT, and Mark learned to code. At 12, he set up his first network, ZuckNet, on which messages and files could be shared between the house and his father's dental office. Rabbi David Holtz of Temple Beth Abraham in Tarrytown told me that he had watched Zuckerberg with other kids and sensed that he was beyond a lot of his peers. He was thinking about things that other people were not. When I asked Zuckerberg where his drive came from, he traced it to his grandparents, who had immigrated from Europe in the early 20th century. They came over, went through the Great Depression, and had very hard lives, he said. Their dream for their kids was that they would each become doctors, which they did, and my mom just always believed that we should have a bigger impact. His eldest sister, Randy, an early Facebook spokesperson, has gone on to write books and host a radio show. Donna received her PhD in classics from Princeton and edits an online classics journal. Ariel has worked at Google and is a venture capitalist. When Zuckerberg was a junior in high school, he transferred to Phillips Exeter Academy, where he spent most of his time coding, fencing, and studying Latin. Ancient Rome became a lifelong fascination, first because of the language. It's very much like coding or math, and so I appreciated that. And then because of the history. Zuckerberg told me, "You have all these good and bad and complex figures. I think Augustus is one of the most fascinating. Basically, though, a really harsh approach. He established 200 years of world peace." For non-classics majors, Augustus Caesar, born in 63 BC, staked his claim to power at the age of 18 and turned Rome from a republic into an empire by conquering Egypt, northern Spain, and large parts of Central Europe. He also eliminated political opponents, banished his daughter for promiscuity, and was suspected of arranging the execution of his grandson. "What are the trade-offs in that?" Zuckerberg said, growing animated. "On the one hand, world peace is a long-term goal that people talk about today. 200 years feels unattainable." On the other hand, he said, that didn't come for free, and he had to do certain things. In 2012, Zuckerberg and Chan spent their honeymoon in Rome. He later said, "My wife was making fun of me, saying she thought there were three people on the honeymoon, me, her, and Augustus. All the photos were different sculptures of Augustus." The couple named their second daughter August. In 2002, Zuckerberg went to Harvard, where he embraced the hacker mystique, which celebrates brilliance in pursuit of disruption. The FU to those in power was very strong, the longtime friend said. In 2004, as a sophomore, he embarked on the project whose origin story is now well known, the founding of thefacebook.com, with four fellow students. The was dropped the following year. The legal battles over ownership included a suit filed by twin brothers, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, accusing Zuckerberg of stealing their idea. The disclosure of embarrassing messages in which Zuckerberg mocked users for giving him so much data. "They trust me, dumb idiots," he wrote. His regrets about those remarks and his efforts in the years afterward to convince the world that he has left that mindset behind. During Zuckerberg's sophomore year, in line for the bathroom at a party, he met Priscilla Chan, who was a freshman. Her parents, who traced their roots to China, had grown up in Vietnam and arrived in the U.S. as refugees after the war, settling in Quincy, Massachusetts, where they washed dishes in a Chinese restaurant. Priscilla was the eldest of three daughters and the first member of her family to go to college. "I suddenly go to Harvard where there's this world where people had real and meaningful intellectual pursuits," she said. "And then I met Mark, who so exemplified that." She was struck by how little Zuckerberg's background had in common with her. 50% of people go to college from the high school I went to. You could learn how to be a carpenter or a mechanic," she said. "I was just like, this person speaks a whole new language and lives in a framework that I've never seen before." And she added, "Maybe there was some judgment on my part. You don't understand me because you went to Phillips Exeter." But, she said, "I had to realize early on that I was not going to change who Mark was." After Harvard, Chan taught in a primary school and eventually became a pediatrician. In 2017, she stopped seeing patients to be the day-to-day head of the Jan Zuckerberg initiative. When I asked Chan about how Zuckerberg had responded at home to the criticism of the past 2 years, she talked to me about Zitzfleisch, the German term for sitting and working for periods of time. He'd actually sit so long that he froze up his muscles and injured his hip, she said. After his sophomore year, Zuckerberg moved to Palo Alto and never left. Even by the standards of Silicon Valley, Facebook's first office had a youthful feel. Zuckerberg carried two sets of business cards. One said, "I'm CEO." Visitors encountered a graphic mural of a scantily clad woman riding a Rottweiler. In Adam Fisher's Valley of Genius, an oral history of Silicon Valley, an early employee named Ezra Callahan muses, "How much was the direction of the Internet influenced by the perspective of 19, 20, 21-year-old, well-off white boys?" That's a real question that sociologists will be studying forever. Facebook was fortunate to launch when it did. Silicon Valley was recovering from the dot-com bust and was entering a period of near messianic ambitions. The Internet was no longer so new that the users were scarce, but still new enough that it was largely unregulated. First movers could amass vast followings and consolidate power, and the coming rise of inexpensive smartphones would bring millions of new people online. Most important, Facebook capitalized on a resource that most people hardly knew existed, the willingness of users to subsidize a company by handing over colossal amounts of personal information for free. In Facebook, Zuckerberg had found the instrument to achieve his conception of greatness. His one-time speechwriter, Catherine Loos, in her memoir, The Boy Kings, explained that the engineering ideology of Facebook was clear. Scaling and growth are everything. Individuals and their experiences are secondary to what is necessary to maximize the system. Over time, Facebook devoted ever greater focus to what is known in Silicon Valley as growth hacking, the constant pursuit of scale. Whenever the company talked about connecting people, that was in effect code for user growth. Over the years, Zuckerberg had come to see his ability to reject complaints as a virtue. But by 2016, that stance had primed the company for a crisis. Tristan Harris, the design ethicist, said, "When you're running anything like Facebook, you get criticized all the time, and you just stop paying attention to criticism if a lot of it is not well-founded. You learn to treat it as naive and uninformed." He went on, "The problem is it also puts you out of touch with genuine criticism from people who are actually understanding the issues." The 2016 election was supposed to be good for Facebook. That January, Sheryl Sandberg told investors that the election would be a big deal in terms of ad spend, comparable to the Super Bowl and the World Cup. According to Burrell Associates, a research and consulting firm, candidates and other political groups were on track to spend $1.4 billion online in the election, up ninefold from 4 years earlier. Facebook offered to embed employees for free in presidential campaign offices to help them use the platform effectively. Clinton's campaign said no. Trump said yes, and Facebook employees helped his campaign craft messages. Although Trump's language was openly hostile to ethnic minorities, inside Facebook his behavior felt, to some executives, like just part of the distant cesspool of Washington. Americans always seem to be choosing between a hated Republican and a hated Democrat, and Trump's descriptions of Mexicans as rapists was simply an extension of that. During the campaign, Trump used Facebook to raise $280 million. Just days before the election, his team paid for a voter suppression effort on the platform. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, it targeted three Democratic constituencies: idealistic white liberals, young women, and African Americans, sending them videos precisely tailored to discourage them from turning out for Clinton. Theresa Hong, the Trump campaign's digital content director, later told an interviewer, "Without Facebook, we wouldn't have won." After the election, Facebook executives fretted that the company would be blamed for the spread of fake news. Zuckerberg's staff gave him statistics showing that the vast majority of election information on the platform was legitimate. At a tech conference a few days later, Zuckerberg was defensive. the idea that fake news on Facebook, of which, you know, it's a very small amount of the content, influenced the election in any way, I think it's a pretty crazy idea, he said. To some at Facebook, Zuckerberg's defensiveness was alarming. A former executive told Wired magazine, "We had to really flip him on that. We realized that if we didn't, the company was going to start heading down this pariah path." When I asked Zuckerberg about his pretty crazy comment, he said he was wrong to have been glib. He told me, "Nobody wants any amount of fake news. It is an issue on an ongoing basis, and we need to take that seriously." But he still bristles at the implication that Facebook may have distorted voter behavior. "I find the notion that people would only vote some way because they were tricked to be almost viscerally offensive," he said, "because it goes against the whole notion that you should trust people and that individuals are smart and can understand their own experience and can make their own assessments about what direction they want their community to go in." Shortly after the election, Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, contacted Facebook to discuss Russian interference. "The initial reaction was completely dismissive," he told me. "But by the spring, he sensed that the company was realizing that it had a serious problem. They were seeing an enormous amount of Russian activity in the French elections," Warner said. "It was getting better, but I still don't think they were putting nearly enough resources behind this." Warner, who made a fortune in the telecom business, added, "Most of the companies in the Valley think that policymakers, one, don't get it, and two, that ultimately, if they just stonewall us, then we'll go away." Facebook moved fitfully to acknowledge the role it had played in the election. In September of 2017, after Robert Mueller obtained a search warrant, Facebook agreed to give his office an inventory of ads linked to Russia and the details of who had paid for them. In October, Facebook disclosed that Russian operatives had published about 80,000 posts, reaching 126 million Americans. I once asked Zuckerberg what he reads to get the news. "I probably mostly read aggregators," he said. "I definitely follow TechMeme, a roundup of headlines about his industry, and the media and political equivalents of that, just for awareness." And he went on, "There's really no newspaper that I pick up and read front to back." Well, that might be true of most people these days. Most people don't read the physical newspaper. But there aren't many news websites where I go to browse. A couple of days later, he called me and asked me to revisit the subject. I felt like my answers were kind of vague because I didn't necessarily feel like it was appropriate for me to get into which specific organizations or reporters I read and follow, he said. "I guess what I tried to convey, although I'm not sure if this came across clearly, is that the job of uncovering new facts and doing it in a trusted way is just an absolutely critical function for society." In March of 2017, Zuckerberg agreed to testify before Congress for the first time about Facebook's handling of user data. The hearing was scheduled for April. As the date approached, the hearing acquired the overtones of a trial. In barely 2 years, the mood in Washington had shifted. Internet companies and entrepreneurs, formerly valorized as the vanguard of American ingenuity and the astronauts of our time, were being compared to Standard Oil and other monopolists of the Gilded Age. This spring, the Wall Street Journal published an article that began, quote, "Imagine a not-too-distant future in which trustbusters force Facebook to sell off Instagram and WhatsApp." It was accompanied by a sepia-toned illustration in which portraits of Zuckerberg, Tim Cook, and other tech CEOs have been grafted onto overstuffed torsos meant to evoke the robber barons. In 1950, Louis Brandeis, the reformer and future Supreme Court Justice, testified before a congressional committee about the dangers of corporations large enough that they could achieve a level of near sovereignty, so powerful that the ordinary social industrial forces existing are insufficient to cope with it, he said. He called this the curse of bigness. Tim Wu, a Columbia Law School professor and the author of a forthcoming book inspired by Brandeis's phrase, told me, "Today, no sector exemplifies more clearly the threats of bigness to democracy than big tech." He added, "When a concentrated private power has such control over what we see and hear, it has a power that rivals or exceeds that of elected government." Shortly before Zuckerberg was due to testify, a team from the Washington law firm of Wilmer Hale flew to Menlo Park to run him through mock hearings and to coach him on the requisite gestures of humility. Even before the recent scandals, Bill Gates had advised Zuckerberg to be alert to the opinions of lawmakers, a lesson that Gates had learned in 1998 when Microsoft faced accusations of monopolistic behavior. Gates testified to Congress, defiantly, that, quote, the computer software industry is not broken and there is no need to fix it, end quote. Within months, the Department of Justice sued Microsoft for violating federal antitrust law, leading to 3 years of legal agony before settlement was reached. Gates told me that he regretted taunting regulators, saying, not something I would choose to repeat. And he encouraged Zuckerberg to be attentive to D.C. I said, get an office there, now. And Mark did, and he owes me, Gates said. Last year, Facebook spent $11.5 million on lobbying in Washington, ranking it between the American Bankers Association and General Dynamics among top spenders. When I asked Zuckerberg whether policymakers might try to break up Facebook, he replied adamantly that such a move would be a mistake. The field is extremely competitive, he told me. I think sometimes people get into this mode of, well, there's not like an exact replacement for Facebook. Well, actually, that makes it more competitive because what we really are is a system of different things. We compete with Twitter as a broadcast medium. We compete with Snapchat as a broadcast medium. We do messaging, and iMessage is the default installed on every iPhone. He acknowledged the deeper concern. There's this other question, which is just, laws aside, how do we feel about these tech companies being big, he said. But he argued that efforts to curtail the growth of Facebook or other Silicon Valley heavyweights would cede the field to China. I think that anything that we're doing to constrain them will first have an impact on how successful we can be in other places, he said. I wouldn't worry in the near term about Chinese companies or anyone else winning in the U.S., for the most part. But there are all these places where there are day-to-day more competitive situations in the Southeast Asia, across Europe, Latin America, lots of different places. The rough consensus in Washington is that regulators are unlikely to try to break up Facebook. The FTC will almost certainly fine the company for violations and may consider blocking it from buying big potential competitors. But, as a former FTC commissioner told me, in the United States, you're allowed to have a monopoly position as long as you achieve it and maintain it without doing illegal things. Facebook is encountering tougher treatment in Europe, where antitrust laws are stronger and the history of fascism makes people especially wary of intrusions on privacy. One of the most formidable critics of Silicon Valley is the European Union's top antitrust regulator, Margrethe Vestager. Last year, after an investigation of Google's search engine, Vestager accused the company of giving an illegal advantage to its shopping service and fined it $2.7 billion. At that time, the largest fine ever imposed by the EU in an antitrust case. In July, she added another $5 billion fine for the company's practice of requiring device makers to pre-install Google apps. In Brussels, Vestager is a high-profile presence, nearly 6 feet tall, with short black and silver hair. She grew up in rural Denmark, the eldest child of two Lutheran pastors, and when I spoke to her recently, she talked about her enforcement powers in philosophical terms. What we're dealing with when people start doing something illegal is exactly as old as Adam and Eve, she said. Human decisions are often guided by greed, by fear of being pushed out of the marketplace, or of losing something that's important to you. And then, if you throw power into that cocktail of greed and fear, you have something that you can recognize throughout time. Vestager told me that her office has no open cases involving Facebook, but she expressed concern that the company was taking advantage of users, beginning with terms of service that she calls unbalanced. She paraphrased those terms as, it's your data, but you give us a royalty-free global license to do basically whatever we want. Imagine, she said, if a brick-and-mortar business asked to copy all your photographs for its unlimited, unspecified uses. Your children, from the first day until the confirmation, the rehearsal dinner for the wedding itself, the first child being baptized, you would never accept that, she said. But this is what you accept without a blink of an eye when it's digital. Investigators view, a healthy market should produce competitors to Facebook that position themselves as ethical alternatives, collecting less data and seeking a smaller share of our user attention. We need social media that will allow us to have a non-addictive, advertising-free space, she said. You're more than welcome to be successful and to dramatically outgrow your competitors if customers like your product. But if you grow to be dominant, you have a special responsibility not to misuse your dominant position to make it very difficult for others to compete against you and to attract potential customers. Of course, we keep an eye on it. If we get worried, we will start looking. As the pressure on Facebook has intensified, the company has been moving to fix its vulnerabilities. In December, after Sean Parker and Chamath Palihapitiya spoke publicly about the damaging psychological effects of social media, Facebook acknowledged evidence that heavy use can exacerbate anxiety and loneliness. After years of perfecting addictive features such as autoplay videos, it announced a new direction. It would promote the quality rather than the quantity of time spent on the site. The company modified its algorithm to emphasize updates from friends and family, the kind of content most likely to promote active engagement. In a post, Zuckerberg wrote, "We can help make sure that Facebook is a time well spent." The company also grappled with the possibility that it would once again become a vehicle for election season propaganda. In 2018, hundreds of millions of people would be voting in elections around the world, including in U.S. midterms. After years of lobbying against requirements to disclose the sources of funding for political ads, the company announced that users would now be able to look up who paid for a political ad, whom the ad targeted, and which other ads the funders had run. The product manager in charge of Facebook's election integrity work told me that the revelations about Russia's internet research agency were deeply alarming. "This wasn't the kind of product that any of us thought that we were working on," he said. With the midterms approaching, the company had discovered that Russia's model for exploiting Facebook had inspired a generation of new actors similarly focused on skewing political debate. Zuckerberg used to rave about the virtues of frictionless sharing. But these days, Facebook is working on imposing friction to slow the spread of disinformation. In January, the company hired Nathaniel Gleicher, the former director for cybersecurity policy on President Obama's National Security Council, to blunt information operations. In July, it removed 32 accounts running disinformation campaigns that were traced to Russia. A few weeks later, it removed more than 650 groups, accounts, and pages with links to Russia or Iran. Depending on your point of view, the removals were a sign either of progress or the growing scale of the problem. Regardless, they highlighted the astonishing degree to which the security of elections around the world now rests in the hands of Facebook. As hard as it is to curb election propaganda, Zuckerberg's most intractable problem may lie elsewhere, in the struggle over which opinions can appear on Facebook, which cannot, and who gets to decide. As an engineer, Zuckerberg never wanted to wade into the realm of content. Finally, Facebook tried blocking certain kinds of material, such as posts featuring nudity, but it was forced to create long lists of exceptions, including images of breastfeeding, acts of protest, and works of art. Once Facebook became a venue for political debate, the problem exploded. In April, in a call with investment analysts, Zuckerberg said glumly that it was proving easier to build an AI system to detect a nipple than what is hate speech. The cult of growth leads to the curse of bigness. Every day, a billion things were being posted to Facebook. At any given moment, a Facebook content moderator was deciding whether a post in, say, Sri Lanka met the standard of hate speech or whether a dispute over Korean politics had crossed the line into bullying. Zuckerberg sought to avoid banning users, preferring to be a platform for all ideas. But he needed to prevent Facebook from becoming a swamp of hoaxes and abuse. His solution was to ban hate speech and impose lesser punishments for misinformation, a broad category that ranged from crude deceptions to simple mistakes. Facebook tried to develop rules about how the punishments would be applied, but each idiosyncratic scenario prompted more rules, and over time they became Byzantine. According to Facebook training slides published by The Guardian last year, the moderators were told that it was permissible to say, "You are such a Jew," but not permissible to say, "Irish are the best, but really French sucks," because the latter was defining another people as inferiors. Users could not write, "Migrants are scum," because it is dehumanizing, but they could write, "Keep the horny migrant teenagers away from our daughters." The distinctions were explained to trainees in arcane formulas such as, quote, "non-protected plus quasi-protected equals not protected." In July, the issue landed inescapably in Zuckerberg's lap. For years, Facebook had provided a platform to the conspiracy theorist, Alex Jones, whose delusions include that the parents of children killed in the Sandy Hook school massacre are paid actors with an anti-gun agenda. Facebook was loath to ban Jones. When people complained that his rants violated rules against harassment and fake news, Facebook experimented with punishments. At first, it reduced him, tweaking the algorithm so that his messages would be shown to fewer people, while feeding his fans articles that fact-checked his assertions. Then, in late July, Leonard Posner and Veronica De La Rosa, the parents of Noah Posner, a child killed at Sandy Hook, published an open letter addressed, "Dear Mr. Zuckerberg," in which they described living in hiding because of death threats from conspiracy theorists, and after an almost inconceivable battle with Facebook to provide us with the most basic of protections. In their view, Zuckerberg had deemed that the attacks on us are immaterial, that providing assistance and removing threats is too cumbersome, and that our lives are less important than providing a safe haven for hate. Facebook relented, somewhat. On July 27th, it took down four of Jones's videos and suspended him for a month. But public pressure did not let up. On August 5th, the dam broke after Apple, saying that the company does not tolerate hate speech, stopped distributing five podcasts associating with Jones. Facebook shut down four of Jones' pages for repeatedly violating rules against hate speech and bullying. I asked Zuckerberg why Facebook had wavered in its handling of the situation. Now, he was prickly about the suggestion. "I don't believe that it's the right thing to ban a person for saying something that is factually incorrect." "Jones seemed a lot more than factually incorrect," I said. "Okay, but I think that facts here are pretty clear," he said, honing in. "The initial questions were around misinformation." And he added, "We don't take it down and ban people unless it's directly inciting violence." He told me that after Jones was reduced, more complaints about him flooded in, alerting Facebook to older posts, and that the company was debating what to do when Apple announced its ban. Zuckerberg said, "When they moved, it was like, okay, we shouldn't just be sitting on this content and these enforcement decisions. We should move on. What we know violates the policy. We need to make a decision now." It will hardly be the last quandary of this sort. Facebook's free speech dilemmas have no simple answers. You don't have to be a fan of Alex Jones to be unnerved by the company's extraordinary power to silence a voice when it chooses, or, for that matter, to amplify others to pull the levers of what we see, hear, and experience. Zuckerberg is hoping to erect a scalable system, an orderly decision tree that accounts for every eventuality and exception. But the boundaries of speech are a bedeviling problem that defies mechanistic fixes. The Supreme Court, defining obscenity, landed on, "I know it when I see it." For now, Facebook is making do with a Rube Goldberg machine of policies and improvisations and Cartoonists are relishing it. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, seized on the ban of Jones as a fascist assault on conservatives. In a moment that was rich, even by Cruz's standards, he quoted Martin Niemöller's famous line about the Holocaust, saying, "As the poem goes, you know, first they came for Alex Jones." Last week, testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Sandberg said, "We now have over 20,000 people, and we are able to review reports in 50 languages, 24 hours a day." In the hallway before the session, as if to underscore the complexities ahead, Alex Jones had made a scene, heckling Senator Mark Rubio for not doing more to get him back on Facebook. In recent years, Sandberg has gained fame for her work outside the company, including her books Lean In, a bestseller on women's empowerment, and Option B, which she wrote after the sudden death of her husband, Dave Goldberg. But her responsibility for the Facebook fallout is likely to grow, and her reputation as COO hinges on the implementation of changes. Many people in Silicon Valley believe that Sandberg and Facebook's board of directors must do more to prevent the company from making another mistake. I know a couple of guys who are colorblind, a prominent executive told me, and their wives lay their clothes out for them in the morning if they don't want to go out every day looking like Bozo the Clown. Cheryl and the board are expected to lay the clothes out for Mark. And he went on, "If you have blind spots, then you rely on the people around you to tell you where they are." In one of our conversations, I asked Zuckerberg whether he finds it insulting when people speculate that he lacks emotions. "Insulting?" he asked, and then paused for several seconds to consider. "I don't find it insulting. I don't think it's accurate. I mean, I definitely care a lot. There's a difference between letting emotions drive impulsive decisions and caring." Then he went on, "Ultimately, I think the reason that we built this successful thing is because we just solve problem after problem after problem, and typically you don't do that by making impulsive, emotional decisions." The caricature of Zuckerberg is that of an automaton with little regard for the human dimensions of his work. The truth is something else. He decided long ago that no historical change is painless. Like Augustus, he is at peace with his trade-offs. Between speech and truth, he chose speech. Between speed and perfection, he chose speed. Between scale and safety, he chose scale. His life thus far has convinced him that he can solve problem after problem after problem, no matter the howling from the public it may cause. At a certain point, the habits of mind that served Zuckerberg well on his ascent will start to work against him. To avoid further crises, he will have to embrace the fact that he's now a protector of the peace, not a disruptor of it. Facebook's colossal power of persuasion has delivered fortune, but also peril. Like it or not, Zuckerberg is a gatekeeper. The era when Facebook could learn by doing and fix the mistakes later is over. The costs are too high, and idealism is not a defense against negligence. In some sense, the Mark Zuckerberg production, as he called Facebook in its early years, has only just begun. Zuckerberg is not yet 35, and the ambition with which he built his empire could well be directed towards shoring up his company, his country, and his name. The question is not whether Zuckerberg has the power to fix Facebook, but whether he has the will, whether he will kick people out of his office with the gusto that he once mustered for the pivot to the mobile, If they don't bring him ideas for preventing violence in Myanmar or protecting privacy or mitigating the toxicity of social media. He succeeded long ago in making Facebook great. The challenge before him now is to make it good. And now we have a time for a few cartoons. In the first one, a woman is coming through a door into the house, and in the house is a young man with a suitcase and a dog on a leash. And he says, "Pack your bags and cancel your plans. The neighbors invited us to dinner, and I told them we'd be out of town." In the next cartoon, we see a lady with a glass of wine sitting on the couch, talking on her cell phone. And she says, "Best of all, he has this wonderful passion for life that he doesn't expect me to share." In the next cartoon, we see a picture of heaven, and on the clouds are two elderly gentlemen. One appears to be God, and in his hands he's got several lightning bolts and a bucket of lightning bolts at his feet. And the other man is reading from a piece of paper, and the other man says to God, "I hate to be a downer, but statistically, people are more likely to die from heart disease than by getting hit by one of those things." Well, sounds like we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it half as much as I enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcasts, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.